News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
Now here's your host, Brad Pepping.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. In the news this week, we hear from SFU professor Jeff Derrickson, who spoke last month at the Impact on Communities conference about the nature of public space in the upcoming Olympics. Following last week's cancellation of UBC's underground bus loop, we ask students what they think of the school's decision not to go ahead with the planned loop. We'll have all this plus sports and your weekly weather forecast coming up this half hour right here on News 101. First up, I'm happy to present this weekly series with the UBC, a look at campus news with Samantha Jung, Charlize Gordon, and Katarina Gorkic, who are in studio this afternoon bringing us the headlines from this week's front page.
Hi, I'm Samantha Jung for Katarina Gorkic and Charlize Gordon, and these are this week's top stories.
TransLink announced last Tuesday afternoon that they are not in a financial position to fund their share of the underground bus loop project proposed for the middle of campus, putting the project on hiatus again. This time, perhaps for good. TransLink did not allocate funding for capital projects in their 10-year plan. The university will now work with TransLink and the campus community to explore viable options through a consultation process.
Fourth-year music student Jared Miller is one of the five composers selected by the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra to compose an Olympic-inspired piece. At 20 years old, he is the youngest recipient. His three-minute piece is titled 2010 Traffic Jam, and Miller drew inspiration from all the sounds and percussion he heard while working around Canby Street. His piece will premiere on December 5th at the Orpheum.
During this year's third annual NASA Regolith Excavation Challenge, a robot built by six UBC students managed to excavate a total of 43 kilograms of moon dust or regolith, thereby securing a solid sixth place for the team. The team, called TREAD, were from the UBC Thunderbird robotics team and had been working on the project since September 2008. The winning team managed to excavate 400 kilograms, but TREAD did not go away defeated. In fact, they were pleased they got the opportunity to test out their design.
UBC students took off their pants to support prostate cancer research last Wednesday afternoon as part of the NEST Recruits Contest. If their charity fundraiser, called UBC Pants Off for Charity, is deemed the most successful out of the teams competing, they stand to win tuition for a year and a paid summer internship at Coca-Cola. The craziness was unfortunately mitigated by the cold, which caused all but the bravest to sport their underwear over tights or pants.
UBC President Stephen Toop once again made the top 10 list of the highest paid employees in BC's public sector. He made the number 3 spot with a salary of $575,813 in 2008. Lisa Castle, UBC's AVP Human Resources, told the UBC that the reason for Toop's high salary is because compensation criteria varies depending on which part of the public sector they belong to, and that UBC looks at other universities in Canada to stay competitive. However, some feel that these high wages are ridiculous in the recession, and the government is not giving enough compensation to respond to the cuts to student aid.
The RCMP are once again under scrutiny due to a recent student investigation which has warranted claims of favoritism and lack of clarity in their issuing of special occasion licenses, or SOLs, on campus. Neil Johnson, editor of the blog UBC Insiders, discovered these discrepancies and is here today to talk to us. Hi, Neil.
Hello.
What is an SOL to start off?
An SOL, a special occasion license, is a one-time liquor license that you need to hold an event on campus. There are some permanently licensed facilities on campus, like the Pitt Pub or Mahoney's or Kerner's. But for any group wanting to hold a special event, like a beer garden, they would have to go get a special occasion license in order to be legal.
How many SOLs have you looked through?
Since January 2008, I think I'm at about 810 currently, but it's an ongoing project. As new SOLs come in, I catalog them, add them to the database, and look for more trends and see what's in there.
What are the problems you have found with the RCMP regarding SOLs?
Well, basically, they've been doing two things. One, they've been instituting extra rules that can't be found in provincial liquor laws, and you cannot find any reference to them in the RCMP's documentation. These are things like minimum price rules and maximum drink rules. But at the same time, they've been disregarding provincial liquor laws. Things like two per month rules, where you can only get two SOLs per month, but organizations like UBC Athletics have gotten over 80 SOLs in a 10-month span. And the RCMP just kind of seems to turn a blind eye and approve these anyways.
So what has been the RCMP and Athletics' responses?
Athletics, for their part, has said that they were completely unaware that they were supposed to be limited to two per month, and they simply applied and were given them and so didn't stop because, you know, I would do the same thing. If I could have a beer garden every day, I would too. RCMP has stated that these were merely oversights, but when you actually look into how many oversights they're talking about, it's actually over 20% of the total SOLs granted every year. In my opinion, that is a rather large oversight.
Thanks, Neil. And I'm Samantha Jung for Charlie's Garden and Katarina Gerchik bringing you the UBC's top stories.
Thanks, guys. It's now time for a break, but stay tuned. Up next, we'll hear from SFU professor Jeff Dirksen.
My life's a stereo, kind of cheaply made, though. How bad does it show?
CATR's fourth annual fund drive is just around the corner. From Thursday, November 12th to Thursday, November 26th, we'll be raising money to support another year of quality community radio. CATR only asks once every year for listeners to support the station. So think about it. How much is a year of CATR programming worth to you? It only comes around once a year, so remember to support CATR this fund drive.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer. Back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Maybe a song from a film or a tune from TV. Radio Free GAC brings you sounds of the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future and the forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Radio Free GAC, Monday evening, 7:30 till 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm Walter Cronkite. I'd like you to hear something.
Any way you want it, that's the way you need it. Any way you want it.
They're radio fans, amateurs, giving of their own time and spending their own money.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Your volunteer-run station.
They're just two average guys who saw the need and volunteered.
You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. It's time for Word on the Street, opinions gathered by reporter Richard Kemick and Alias Omid for a student perspective on UBC's decision not to go ahead with plans for an underground bus loop. So, gentlemen, what did you find when you were speaking to students?
Well, thanks, Brad. Originally, UBC and TransLink had planned for a joint venture in which they both supported the building of an underground bus loop at UBC. After various delays in construction, TransLink has just recently pulled their funding, forcing UBC to shut down the project altogether. Elias talked to students recently at the Student Union Building. Elias, what did you find?
When I went to the sub, I met a bunch of people. Some of them actually didn't know about this decision, but I met actually three people, and they have some. I mean, they have talked to me and hear what they say.
Well, I don't use the bus because I do have my own transportation, but I do see the use in it for those students who can't. Well, either don't have a car or don't have the means to get here without bus. And I think better transportation here would be very important for those students. The bus loop shouldn't be cancelled. This is a massive university, and it's going to be expanding more and more. And more students are going to be wanting to use the public transport as this university keeps growing. So I definitely think it's not a good decision.
Actually, I agree with here my colleague. The public transportation is so important for students. I mean, we do need a way to get to stop traffic, because we are a lot of people traveling or commuting to school, to classes, and if we have a public transportation, all of us can get here on time and nobody has to be late for school, right? Because traffic is the problem that will just get worse and worse with time. So even just for economical reasons and for traffic reasons, it would be a shame to it is a shame that that bus loop got cancelled.
Well, I think it's not a good idea to cancel, because to be honest, most of the time the transit are usually full, you know, is people always miss bus and stuff just because the bus is full. So I think we really need an underground bus route. Yeah.
There were Visana and Mike Ross talked to us about cancellation of underground bus loop. Personally, actually, I agree with interviewers, because this is a huge university and we should have a bus loop system. I mean, if we have an underground bus loop, or if we have more buses, that will be, I mean, actually more convenient for people, because many students use bus and most of the students live off campus. If we had that, that would be great.
Thanks, Elias. This closure of the planned bus loop means that students will also have to continue to rely on the temporary bus loop located to the east of the Students' Union building. Brad, back to you.
Thanks, guys, for compiling that. The Impact on Communities conference was held last month in Vancouver to discuss how the city will be affected by the upcoming Winter Olympics. Tonight we bring you a speech by SFU professor Jeff Dirksen, who invited the audience to think about how the Olympic Games will change our conceptions of public and private space.
Some of the language that's being used obviously is completely ironic and kind of hilarious, but at the same time points towards a really problematic aspect of not only what's happening, but how it cuts against our kind of common senses and the way that we think about the city. So I just had four quick points I wanted to make, which I'll echo what people have said already. And a couple of the points are about space and how we think about space and perhaps what space might even be, because a lot of these the struggles and the clampdowns that are happening, the way that people are thinking of organizing, is deeply spatial. And by that, I mean that it takes place in space, but it's also is productive of space. It makes space. So if we think of space as a process rather than space as an existing container, we start to think that space is made by particular activities. And then that allows us to think of a way that public space doesn't just exist, but public space is made through particular actions. So a lot of the things that people are talking about tonight is a way of making space public. On the other hand, we can look at the kind of security clampdowns that are coming and think of that as a way of making private space, of privatizing space. And this becomes a kind of fundamental poles, I think, of the struggle in the way that it can be thought of. So it's a transformation of space. It's not just that public space gets used for something else later, but it gets transformed into privatized space. I think that's what Matt's really pointing towards. Like, why do we need security guards in front of all of these different places? Why is this continual guarding of space happening? Why are these places always being restricted? Secondly, I want to point out that by clamping down on the use of public space, by privatizing public space, it limits who becomes understood as public. It limits what kinds of publics can use space. And we already see that through all of the great points that people are making, how you get excluded from the public by doing particular things. Things as benign as wearing a t-shirt, things as benign as waving a sign. So again, any change in privatizing space changes who can use it and the notion of of what publics are. Because the public doesn't exist, the public's a process as well. So if we think of making the public, this is part of all the democratic actions that people are talking about tonight, I think. Thirdly, I just wanted to add a little bit more about this idea of neoliberalism. Again, a very tricky word, a very clunky word. It's a word that's used a lot more in Latin America and Europe than it is in North America. For instance, the Liberal Party here in British Columbia is a classic neoliberal party, but they will never utter the word. They won't say, we are neoliberals, because neoliberalism implies, again, a lack of freedom. But neoliberalism, let's think of neoliberalism as a kind of globally migrating philosophy and a globally migrating form of governance. So hearing the very kind of powerful stories where people were talking about the different types of clampdowns that are going to happen, I started thinking, oh yeah, when I was in such and such a city, New York in 1999 was the first time that I was at a protest put into a free speech zone. You know, it was kind of like four people and one cop. We were buying him coffees and stuff. New York cops actually don't get paid very much. So you start to see that neoliberalism becomes a governance that circulates globally and it gets picked up. So it comes from certain places and it lands down and it gets picked up by local governments. So it's global and local at the same time. So it's not unique to Vancouver. But one thing that's characteristic of neoliberalism as a form of governance, the way that governmentality happens, is that it tends to set up structures that don't work democratically. It tends to try to block collective actions, and it has a love of experts, even if the experts aren't informed in things they're supposed to be experts in. And actually, I think a lot of the laughs that we got tonight were from these kinds of experts who, you know, I did my research, I looked for 5 minutes on the website, and like things that you would never kind of consider yourself an expert as. And I was reading The Province the other day. There's a really great, what begins as a good story about Wendy Pedersen and the great work that the Carnegie Community Center is doing. And Wendy Pedersen says that, you know, we have to have a paradigm shift for how we think about the downtown east side. And we have to start thinking about representing zones of safety and stuff in the downtown east side in a different way. And then to get a response to Wendy, they talked to someone called Bernie Magnan, who's the Vancouver Board of Trade's chief economist. So rather than talking to someone from the city who maybe has some democratic influence where we know who we could go talk to in a sense, they turned to someone who's an economist, not an urbanist, and he says, they say, Bernie Magnan, the Vancouver Board of Trade's chief economist, hadn't read the report that the Carnegie Community Center produced, but said that gentrification doesn't have to be seen as scary. Quote, if the changes that happen in the community are done properly, then it can help people, said Magnan. There are times when the word gentrification is used as a synonym for everything going to high-priced living accommodation rather than just looking at whether it can help contribute to the improvement of the community for everyone, including the existing residents. So what he's saying is that gentrification, the word gentrification doesn't mean gentrification, and that gentrification is not actually gentrification. But I'm saying all this without actually knowing what I'm talking about because I didn't read the report. So I just think that it's a benign, stupid little example from the province, but why the hell should this person be speaking publicly on this at all? And this shows a shift in the way that neoliberal governance happens. It's a reliance on these experts who obviously don't know what they're supposed to be experts in, but they always say we need to privatize, we desperately need to privatize. So the scary part about that everyone's pointed out to very effectively and dramatically, I think, is that after we have the moment of exception of the Olympics, not only do the cameras stay and all the other infrastructure of surveillance, which has led actually to some quite fun arts programs and artistic practices, like there's a group in New York that does tours where they lead you around the city, taking you on the route that where you'll be surveilled the least by different cameras and stuff. So there's ways of turning this right to the city into a different type of right as well. But what, after the Olympics are gone and all of the cameras are still here, what's left as well is a form of doing governance, a neoliberal form of making decisions. And that decision-making increasingly means asking certain experts their opinions. So if you want an opinion on whether it's a good time to buy a house or how, or some sort of urban question, they turn to the condo king and they ask him, what's the condo king think? They turn to an economist to say that gentrification is nothing to worry about. So I think that would be, unfortunately, the legacy of the games would be that there's a shift in the structure of how decision-making gets made within the city. And then simply my last point is that tonight we've kind of been hovering around a little bit, but also zoning right into this notion of the idea of the right to the city. We've talked a little bit about David Harvey, who's an urban geographer, who really picked up on the notion of the right to the city, and that the right of the city is not just the right to have access to public space, but really is the right to imagine the city in an image that you would like to see it happen in. It's really also, it has this kind of imaginative engagement. Harvey's drawing from this French philosopher, Henri Lefebvre, who lived for a long time and in Paris and really worked through all the different changes and eruptions in Paris. And what's so wonderful with Lefebvre is that for like 60 years of his life, he absolutely railed against the control of the city, he absolutely railed against the way that the textures of the city were being erased. He railed against the way that this kind of lack of imagination of the city was erasing all of these production, all of this production of space, all of this from the ground up kind of activity. And I think Lefebvre is wonderfully inspirational at the moment. And will supply the exact kind of pointed analysis that adds to the kind of thing that we've been talking tonight. So pardon my teacherly moment, but thank you.
Thanks, Carrie Baptist, for recording that speech. We're going to take another break, but stay tuned. Sports and weather are next. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I've survived for a reason to tell my story to touch lives.
Hip-hop artist Emmanuel Jal, once a child soldier in Sudan, has returned to his home country, and this time his weapon is a microphone. His unique story and effort to build peace, War Child, is just one of the 25 films featured this year at the Amnesty International Film Festival, November 12th to 15th at the Van City Theater, 1181 Seymour Street. Full program available at amnestyfilmfest.ca. Brought to you in part by CITR Radio.
Me, I got a reason for being on this earth, cause no more than many words, life is worth enough. Now that I get a chance to stand my ground, I'm gonna run over mountains, leaps and bounds.
Green College presents a series of lectures by Olympic critics, organizers, and academics highlighting many of the negative impacts of the Olympic Games. Vancouver will soon host the 2010 Winter Olympic Games, promoted by the organizers and government as a major benefit for Vancouver, British Columbia, and Canada. Yet, negative impacts of the Games are already being felt. Cost overruns have become routine. The athletes' village risks making the city of Vancouver insolvent. There has been environmental damage. Unceded indigenous land and resources are being exploited. And homelessness has increased by over 400% since 2003. Lectures are taking place most Mondays from September 14th to December 7th at 5 p.m. at the Green College Coach House. The lectures are free and open to the public. For more information on individual speakers, visit www.greencollege.ubc.ca.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. Right now it's 5:24 and time for Thunderbird Eye on Sports with Wilson Wong.
Welcome to Thunderbird Eye as we look back at another busy and exciting weekend. The first men's regular season basketball game of the year didn't live up to the hype surrounding it, but UBC is still mighty happy after clobbering Trinity Western 71-44 on Halloween night. Both teams are considered favorites to win the Canada West Conference. After a nervous start from both teams, Thunderbird Josh White ignited a huge UBC run that bridged the first and second quarter. White scored the first 8 points of a 24-2 run by UBC that almost decided the game by halftime. At the break, UBC led 34-13. It was one of the lowest scoring halves by any CIS team ever. White and Blaine LeBranch both led UBC with 16 points, and CIS Player of the Year Jacob Dirksen from TWU was held to just 9. He battled UBC's Graham Bath, who had this to say after the game.
It's a real good start. We wanted to win the battle of the rebounding. I think we did that. We didn't turn the ball over. This is game one. It's a 20-game-plus season. You know, we're trying to get all the way to nationals. I think it's a great start, but we've still got a lot of work to do.
UBC is in Oklahoma to play 2 exhibition games against NCAA schools. Their game tonight is against Oral Roberts. It just started at the top of the hour, and you can catch live video of it at the Oral Roberts website. On the women's side, Leah St. Pierre had one of the most memorable games of her career in Friday's UBC win. She was noticeably injured in the first quarter, but still made a quick cut to the basket and scored a nice hoop for UBC. But when she came back on defense, she was so uncomfortable, she literally ran off the court, leaving UBC on defense with 4 players. So what happened?
I actually threw up.
When St. Pierre came back on the court, she was one of the best players in the game, finishing with 17 points. That was just one behind teammate Alex Viewegg, who led all players in scoring. Final score 74-52 UBC over Trinity Western. And here's St. Pierre again.
Well, last year we kind of went through a bit of a tough time because we had so many rookies. We're just trying to get a flow on the court. So this year, I mean, the chemistry is a lot better. The competitiveness in practice has really gone up. So, I mean, we're trying to work really hard as a team and, you know, play tough games like this.
UBC has a bye this weekend. The men's soccer team is the regular season Canada West Conference champion. This after an unusual weekend in southern Alberta. UBC came into the weekend tied with Trinity Western for first place. The Thunderbirds beat Calgary 4-0 on Friday. But Trinity Western lost 2-1 to Lethbridge, one of the worst teams in the league. So when UBC tied Lethbridge 1-1, that gave the Birds the conference championship. They finished the year on a 7-game unbeaten streak. UBC will be hosting the conference playoffs this week. Their first game is against Alberta at 7:30 Friday night. The women's soccer team finishes the year on a 6-game conference winning streak, this after beating Victoria 1-0 and Fraser Valley 2-1 on the road this weekend. UBC plays Victoria again in the first round of the playoffs on Friday afternoon. The women's volleyball team is on a 4-match winning streak to start the year. They swept their weekend series at Trinity Western, winning Friday night in straight sets and then in 5 sets on Saturday. The men's team lost both their games to TWU at the Langley Events Center over the weekend. They now sit at 1-3 on the year. The Women's Rugby National Championships begin Friday morning at UBC with the first game at 10 a.m. UBC is seeded 5th in the tournament. The men's rugby team beat the Vancouver Rowing Club 24-11 on Halloween to move into a tie for first place in their league. The women's field hockey team is ranked number 2 heading into this week's CIS National Championships in Victoria. The Thunderbirds will start the round robin part of the tournament against the top seed Guelph on Thursday at 9:30 a.m. And the women's ice hockey team lost both their games on the road this weekend against Manitoba. UBC is now on a 4-game losing streak. That's your look at UBC sports from this past weekend. Tune in tomorrow for Wiener's Barbecue for more coverage of Thunderbirds sports. I'm Wilson Wong.
Thanks, Wilson, for that report. Now it's time for this week's weather report, and for that we go to Alice Huang.
Thanks, Brad. Here's your forecast for November 2nd to November 6th. We saw a bit of rain during the early afternoon hours today due to a weak cold front. There's a slight chance of showers Monday evening to the overnight as the tail end of the cold front passes through the region. Tonight's overnight low is 5 degrees. Tuesday, a ridge of high pressure will build over the west coast, so expect mostly sunny conditions and a high of 11 degrees. Wednesday, we'll see a mix of sun and cloud with fairly mild temperatures of 13 degrees for the daytime high. Thursday, there will be a significant change on the way. We'll have to watch out for the next Aleutian low pressure system coming in from the Gulf of Alaska. Aleutian lows are strong maritime systems that cause windy conditions and stormy weather as well. Thursday will be mainly overcast with windy conditions, with periods of rain developing in the evening and a daytime high of 13. Friday, it will be a very unsettled day as the low-pressure system passes through. There will be heavy showers, strong wind gusts, and possibly some small hail due to the unstable air mass. Currently, it's 8 degrees and cloudy at YVR. That's your weather for this week, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. For News 101, I'm Alice Huang.
Thanks, Alice. And that's our program for Monday, November 2nd, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Megan Turcato produced this radio program. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Brad Pepink. For the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track on 101.9 FM CITR.